You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So it's now my pleasure to introduce Dara McAnulty. He's going to be in conversation with Molly, one of our trustees. And Dara has got lots of things that he's done. So I can't remember them all. I'm going to have to read it from my book, how much all the things he's done. He's a naturalist, writer, and environmental campaigner. He's the youngest ever winner of the RSPB medal. He, in 2023, got a British Empire Medal for services to the environment and people with autism. He started writing a blog in his teens called Naturalist Dara, and is the author of The Diary of a Young Naturalist. He's also written some children's books. He's studying natural sciences at Cambridge, and he will be having book signing at 12:30 and 6 today, if you'd like to talk to him more about and get a book signed. That's everything for me. So I'm going to hand over to Molly and Dara. Can we give them a round of applause?
Dara.
Yeah.
You've been busy.
Just a bit.
Just a little bit. Yeah. It's such a joy to be in conversation with you. It's so lovely to be here in the hot house. Welcome to Greenbelt.
Yeah. It's incredible to be here. And this decoration, I walked in, I was like, oh my word, this is like so cool. Yeah.
We've named the spaniel. He's called Kevin.
Yeah.
So just so you all know, Kevin the spaniel is a fixture in the hot house. He's here in Pride and Place. So we've used our time on the stage well so far.
Yeah, I think.
So Greenbelt is all about arts and faith and activism, and arts and activism is your DNA as well. So we were chatting a little bit before we got here about art and writing as activism. How has that played out for you over the last few years?
So I believe that arts and activism are integral to each other. In recent years, as we come under increasing levels of threat, the requirement for us to step up and take action has become more and more important in the face of climate change, Palestine. We are consistently under threat, and our government seems entirely inadequate at dealing with these issues. And activism has now become really essential. But whenever I was younger, I really couldn't deal with crowds, or I was a very nervous little autistic child. But my way out of trying to do something was writing. The incredible Billy Bragg put it quite well, in that he was saying that actual action doesn't come from art. A song doesn't change the world. However, it can create a community. It can create a voice piece. It can create an atmosphere of change, and then the people make the change, because people drive change, and art brings us together. And as you don't get protest movements, you don't get activism without art. It doesn't come from nowhere. And so I was trying to write about how we can just force the issues to as many people as possible and try to speak up. And then the people will also rise up too. And then I went to actual protests and got very, very, very angry. And then I was like, but I've still got to keep on writing and writing. So I wrote the books. I was just all over the place. And then I went to university and discovered that how much you really need both. You need people to pay attention. You need people to listen. And I think that art and activism in that way are just intrinsically linked.
Yeah, fantastic answer. I mean, I think art making is such a beautiful and brilliant thing.
Yeah.
And it's something that often can be difficult to find your way into. And I think what I love about your writing recently, especially your children's literature, is that you are not just writing for your own writing, you're writing to empower other people, especially people who might not think that they have that voice, that niche within arts and activism, to do that for themselves, so, and especially children. So what inspired you to write children's literature?
So I decided to write children's literature for two main reasons. The first is that I believe in education. I believe that if children can't care about things that they don't know about, I wrote the Wild Child books to try and show people what the world is like if they walk out their door. I didn't want to impose any rules, like you have to experience the natural world in this way, this way, this way, which I feel like we can sort of slide into, like, and you have to follow these specific rules in a specific way, and it becomes a requirement on experience. I wrote them because I thought, no, we need an invitation into the natural world, not a... not orders. And so I was just, here's all of the information in my brain, activities that I think are fun, and I really gave me a chance to just be as autistic as hell. Yes. About every single bit of information that I had locked in my brain over the years. It is literally three books of info dump. Yeah. And I could not be happier about doing it. And the other reason was that whenever I wrote my first book, I was not in a good state mentally. Mm. I was a little bit insane, as anyone who probably knew me at that time probably would say I was quite intense. They're right. They were right. Although that intensity, I think... It was needed at that time.
I'd say it's paid off.
Just about.
Yeah.
And then... But the diary went into a lot of those issues, which is why I needed to... there's something about doing something that's autobiographical that was entirely unplanned, and putting your diary entries to the public, that is always a little bit mind-bending.
Sure.
Like, and especially writing the summer bit of that book... felt it was quite painful, and I was just like, I really need to just write about something happy.
Mm.
I need to give hope. We live in quite a desperate world at the moment. I need to give as much hope as possible, but not like the slightly pathetic type of hope, which is it'll all turn out right in the end. No, the type of hope that says, no, we can change things if we try. Mm. And if we try hard enough, and look at what we should be protecting. And I made a very distinct promise to myself writing these books that they were going to be positive. I was not going to be doing the thing in every single nature documentary ever where they go for it, you see all of this wonderful nature, and then the announcer with the white text on the black screen at the end, "This population of penguins has declined by 80% in the last 4 years. The world is nearly ending. We can't do anything." Ah! Yeah. And leaving this miserable message at the very, very end, which sort of makes you feel like you can't do anything. Whereas if you take it from a more positive angle, I feel like we're like, no, no, no. Mm. We can do something about that, because... whenever you hear those hopeful stories, you suddenly go, actually, it works. And yes, the world is going through horrible, horrible things, but there are also amazing people out there doing incredible things. Mm. And making people aware of that end of it, I think it lulls you out of that sort of eco-anxiety depression that just makes you just want to curl up in a ball and do nothing, which doesn't really help anyone, which was really why I wrote Wild Child, was that I wanted to go to those children and just go, no, 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 no. It's okay. The world is a beautiful, magical place. You can do something about this. But it's first of all, it's not just up to you. It's about everyone coming together. One person can't do anything, but a lot of people can. And also, you just need to go out into the natural world and fall in love with it again.
Yeah.
Even in despite all of these terrible things that are happening.
Teaching joy and teaching hope as an act of resistance, as part of your activism. That's such a beautiful thing. Where are you finding those things for sustaining you as an activist, as a writer at the moment?
I think there's a bunch of things. Like, first of all, the natural world itself. Hmm. I just saw a red kite overhead whenever
had a
I was
red
flying.
Kite moment.
I was like, oh my goodness me. I feel like there's a lot of them in this area, but I was just like, yes.
That's still exciting.
And
every time.
Every single time I see one, my brain just goes, yes. That gives me hope. That gives me the joy that I need to keep on going. Also, just seeing so many different organizations really putting their back and working so hard to try and make a difference really does like whenever you see that it every time I see good things happening I've sort of tried to come up with a sort of positivity bias where I just sort of try and see the good, and then whenever the bad stuff happens get incredibly angry and write. I flip between two types of writing. One is very calm, very lovely, very pretty, and the other is demonic rage demon. And honestly, both are quite fun. Although the rage is honest. I just type at immense speed, and then I usually at about 2 a.m. and I read it the morning after. I'm like, whoo.
I think we've all been there.
Yeah.
Kind of read the rage email and gone, oh.
That may have been a mistake. Yeah. I still stand by what I said, but you weren't supposed to hear it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you were speaking earlier about the particular kind of intensity. We were talking earlier as well about the particular kind of intensity that comes with being autistic people in the world. I'm also an autistic person. I imagine there are many NeuroSpicy friends with us as well. I found it really interesting. So we didn't know what the title of this was going to be until we were sent it. We didn't choose autism as an eco superpower. What do you think about that kind of idea of autism as a superpower? I know that you speak a lot and you write beautifully about being autistic in the world, being autistic in the natural world, and the particular way in which your brain notices things, processes things, you know, being commissioned to infodump, for example, is
so good.
But what do you think about that idea as autism as superpower?
I it's a really conflicting statement for me, because clearly I'm just human. I'm assuming we all are here today. We've all got different things going on, but nothing that I would say is directly a superpower. Some of us are really, really good at cooking. Some of us will burn toast. We all have different ways of seeing the world, different processings. Like, we objectively see the world differently to each other. Like, I'm colorblind, red-green colorblind. I'll see different things. Does that make people who can see somehow have a superpower? But no. I've just got a different... I don't know what it's like to be neurotypical. I don't care to experience that, but it's okay. Neurotypical's fine too. But it's just different ways of seeing the world, and that makes you better or worse at different things. If I remember, infamously, I once walked into like a Lindt chocolate shop, and all of the different colors, and with all of the shining wrappers, and I just straight up fainted on the spot. However, I can go to a really, really loud concert without any ear protection. I know it's bad, but I need to feel my entire body shaking.
Sure.
And that's completely fine for me. But for some other people, I'm sure they love Lindt chocolate shops. And it's just these different ways of experiencing the world. So maybe if autism is a superpower, well, then we're all super... Oh, that's so cringy. We're all got superpowers in our own special way. But, like, sort of, if we're going to say that autism is a superpower, which I don't think we should, then we have to say that as well. Or we could just all be normal humans and just leave it there and try to do the best we can.
Yeah. So the natural world is, I think, we're beyond special interest at this point.
It just is.
Yeah.
It's always been the natural world. I feel like it's the most, it's been there for so long. All of my other special interests have like come and gone and shifted. However, this one's, and they always somehow lead back to the natural world. Mm. Like, my current special interest is wolves. Who would have thought? But that's still the natural world. I always come back. So it's like my little engine that powers all of the other ones. Through probably some like seventh degree, some connection sometimes, but it gets there in the end.
Absolutely.
It's sort of my like root that I then grow out of everything else. And because whenever I go into the natural world, I just feel calm. My brain is consistently fighting with both itself and its surroundings. I'm consistently just going, it's always just so loud, and I walk into a forest and it completely disappears. I can just go, here is real human existence. These are all of my worries. Then I go through that gate and I'm just like, not allowed to have them in here. Nature's too pretty to be worried while I'm there. I've got to really chill. I've got to actually quieten down the voices and the moments in my brain and that embarrassing thing I did 12 years ago. I've got to pan all of that out, and then I can actually think for probably the first time that day. I need it. But I feel it's also like the color thing as well. I remember vividly, my most hated class was Spanish. Now, this has nothing to do with the Spanish language. It's the flag I have a problem with. Those colors are the single two worst color combinations I've ever seen.
Oh, no.
And you can imagine in the Spanish classroom, just Spanish flags
full on
everywhere.
Oh.
And I could not focus in that classroom. And so I had to, every 10 minutes, we had like, it was in like a mobile home with some trees next to it. And I would just be like, every 5 minutes, I would have to walk out, come tree back break. In again. Literally go on a tree break every like,
yes.
Every like 20, 15 minutes, just so I could bear those colors.
I love that.
Because like, I feel like they were like, oh my God, we've got to make our classroom so bright and airy. And I'm like, please, no, give me muted colors. And that's the thing about the natural world. It's usually got like a quite more restricted palette. Mm. And my brain is just like, yes, oh, I can think again.
Yeah.
And so I need the natural world. Otherwise, my life sort of goes straight into the abyss.
Absolutely. I mean, in Diary of a Young Naturalist, you talk about particular places in the natural world you talk about your chapels.
Yes.
Which I love. Not just because I'm a priest, but also. What are your chapels at the moment? Where are the places that are most precious to you?
So currently I'm studying in Cambridge. And so Grantchester Meadows.
Oh yeah.
I go out there with my friends and we just sort of sit there for ages. I remember last year we do like an end of term like picnic there, and it was really, really misty. And then a barn owl just flew beside us. And my brain just like short circuited for a while. Wow. I was just like, huh? What? Like there's something that you just feel like it's a thinner pice. Mm. You just feel like you're connecting with something else. Mm. Like the moment that the world sort of goes silent for that briefest moment. And that's what defines like that sort of chapel experience for me is it feels, you feel close to something. In Irish, we sort of have a word for this called uaighness, which sort of just means lonely tranquility.
Gosh, that's that beautiful.
You can feel something else out there. One of my personal favorites is Ballynostode Circle, which is in the diary, and I always feel like all my ancestors are watching me in that place. You feel connected to all of the stuff around you, especially whenever you're there alone and you're just there. It's like it's loneliness in the that there is a pang. There is a sort of like it's like how I'm trying to translate a Irish word with a very specific meaning into English because there is no English word for this experience.
Yeah.
But it's the idea of being alone, but everything is watching you and is with you.
Wow.
Like you look out into the sea and it just keeps going.
A kind of relational aloneness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, and that's what makes those sort of places for me. Those, and I go back to them again and again and again whenever I just need something more spiritual, I guess.
Mm.
Because it is a spiritual experience. It's connecting with my ancestors. It's connecting with the land. And it's connecting myself to the stories of that land as well. Like, how many things have happened in this place? You can feel it all at the same time. And I find that a really, really powerful experience.
Yeah. Do you ever feel conflicted between being a scientist and a storyteller?
I feel more conflicted about being a scientist because most of them are either insane or evil. Sure. Half the time.
Sorry to any scientists out there.
Here, I'm a scientist. It's fine. I can... I've found that, but I think that most scientists should like learn how to engage with the world on an empathetic level, that they should read stories, that they should be storytellers. Science is really finding a story of the world that works on an empirical basis, that you've seen the world, you've done your experiments, and you are making up the best story that you can to fit the model. And if you don't have any of the like empathy or the storytelling ability or the creativity or the culture behind that, you're going to start saying some really, really dodgy things. We're going to end up in a situation which we increasingly find ourselves in where scientists really need more ethics courses. They need to understand how things are interlinked and that it may be that there are points where science doesn't really explain everything, which I think is becoming increasingly important. So yeah, there is a slight conflict, but only in that I think more scientists should learn how to not storytellers in like offer sense, but people who care more about the story, the stories that they are telling, and understanding that everything that you publish or say is inherently a story, that it is, you are telling people stuff, and that requires knowledge of how to be a storyteller.
Yeah. And is this how you sort of found your way to focusing on philosophy and history of science at the moment? Is kind of what you're up to in...
Yeah, so I'm doing a history and philosophy of science master's because I did it in second year, and it made me go as slightly insane as I realized that everything I believed about science wasn't a little bit shakier. And I was consistently just going, I need to understand why we use science in certain ways and how science is being used in the past. Like, because my current project is on how science was used for the extinction of wolves in Ireland, how the basic scientific theories of Francis Bacon were then used in, like, colonial context to cause speciesize and ruin cultures, essentially. And it was all essentially coming from these scientific principles of experimentation, exploitation, and trying to understand that what could not be understood, i.e. Irish people. And I think that I don't think I can continue learning about science until I fix this little bit. Because I remember one of my supervisors brought... I unfortunately had missed a few supervisions because I was being a bit chaotic. And
we've all been there.
And she was like, okay, I can give you 2 hours on one-on-one. And it was the most insane experience of my life, as she basically took me through... I think we ran up to 3 hours in the end.
Wow.
As we went over a lot of history. I would say a thing to her, and she would just completely pick it apart.
Wow.
Bit by bit by bit. And then I was at the end going, oh no. And I
little bit of an existential crisis.
Oh yeah. Every single supervision in that course was single-handedly breaking me down bit by bit until I was going, I need to get to the bottom of this at some point. Otherwise I'm not going to ever sleep again.
I love that you just described basically interrogating the whole of Western scientific methodology as fixing this little bit.
Yeah. Like, I need to get to the bottom of that bit. I feel like it's important. Who would have thought? I need to understand why it ended up in that state. Because also making sure that whenever scientists do come up with good theories, how do we actually get people to listen to them after time is becoming increasingly important, especially with climate change, because we have the solutions. 90% of the time, we usually have a solution to an environmental problem, be that from historical sources, indigenous people, new scientific theories, and nearly all of the time, it is... getting that information to people and then them actually doing the thing. That becomes increasingly the issue. So I think that is also...
And you... How many years ago did you write Diary of a Young Naturalist?
Oh no.
A while. 6 years?
Six years, because I wrote in 2019, published in 2020.
So suddenly... You were doing your GCSEs.
Yep.
And you found yourself thrust into that work of being a science communicator and doing that stuff of getting people to care about the things.
Yeah.
That was... Wild time?
I don't remember it.
No.
I have about a blank memory space between about 13 and up until I was about 18. Gosh. I do not remember any of it. If I talk to people at that time... I'm so sorry if I've ghosted you. it's really because I go back from my DMs occasionally. I'm like, oh my goodness me, I clocked out of that.
Oh, same.
back in the and I think all of that stuff going on just overloaded my brain. I think because I published a book during COVID. It was just Zoom call after Zoom call after Zoom call. Sure. And I was like, I have nothing else to do. So I will do, I was basically doing like 12 interviews a week.
Oh my God. Plus exams.
Well, school's out. It was
during the summer holiday.
Yeah. No, well, it was lockdown.
Clearly, I've blanked it out. Yeah. As well. Completely.
It's just like a. It's just like a. I feel like those years have just sort of like smushed into like a little
kind of concertinas.
And so, I feel like I did what I usually do, which is just go, okay, this is happening now. I'll do something. Maybe it'll be interesting. I'll tell people about it, and then the book did decently well. Much to my
understatement of the century, but okay.
I was I was not expecting that, but I was really I was like, why are they reading this? This is my diary.
How did you get that?
Yeah, like, what is going on here? What do you mean? But it was a really wild time. But it also taught me, surprisingly, how to be social. With autism, my social skills at that time were essentially zero. I used to not even speak to people. I used to have little cards that I would just use to like tell people things, because I just really struggled to get words, or I would have like these days where I would just be I'd be like in school, not talk to anyone, completely silent, and then I feel like being thrust into that world and suddenly having to probably did mean that I could actually talk to people, which I'm very, very grateful for, because people are actually quite nice. I quite like being able to speak to people. So that time, yeah, it was definitely an interesting one.
There are some very good ones out there, aren't there?
Yeah,
as far as peopling goes.
Yeah.
If only we could tell our previous selves that it was all going to be all right.
Yeah, it's going to be fine. It's going to be like, no, the people that you're going to talk to are not, like, they're not that scary. It's fine.
Are there any particular people that you've met as a result of Diary of a Young Naturalist and the rest of your writing and the work that you've really enjoyed?
I've got to say Chris Packham.
What a easily
legend. Chris Packham, he was the one who brought me into that world.
Amazing.
I was basically I was writing the blog at the time, and he was like, come on Springwatch, and I was just like, oh, and then like
just that's a normal one.
And we're still friends after, and he is the coolest person I've ever met, so yeah. And the other coolest person is probably Steve Backshall. He's so lovely. He's so gentle. It's like, I'm just like, oh my god. And being 13, 14 year old who watched Deadly 60,
absolutely obsessed with Deadly 60 as a kid.
It was literally the show that I would watch it again and again and again and again and again, until I think I had the entire show, all seasons, memorized.
Amazing.
And then meeting him was just like, oh.
Do the words.
Words, please. I was just like, he's really, really, he's so lovely.
Brilliant.
But I feel like meeting those people was one of those moments where I was just like, oh, maybe this whole like being this communication thing, this speaking thing, actually is quite good. And it also taught me that you do need to speak to people to actually get help, that you need to talk to people if you want to do anything decent in the world. You have to reach out, you have to find community, find other people, you have to join up. Because as one person, you're scared, alone, and you can't read, and a little bit, not always, but mostly useless. However, when together, strong, and you can actually do something. And I found that probably the most profound change of my life over those years.
Yeah. So you found your niche and your people in, I would say, a fairly unique way.
Yeah.
For those of us who are maybe seeking that sense of purpose, and for those of us who use the word vocation, that kind of the thing that we're here for,
yeah,
and the people who might help us on the way, where would you Where do you start with that?
So I feel like your community is your first place. Mm. Like, the people that are already there tend to be the ones who can actually help the most. Mm. Finding, in your local area, finding people. I remember there was this incredible project in Belfast where they created these garden alleys, these community gardens in the alleyways.
Oh, great.
And it connected all of these people together because the alleyways in Belfast are a twisting, winding network of that could have straight out of the labyrinth. Mm. People just decided to come together and plant and make these gardens. And most of these houses didn't have gardens of their own. They were all terraced houses. And I remember I would go out to these gardens whenever I lived in Belfast. And the community that grew up around those places meant that people who would ordinarily have never have chatted were suddenly all connected by this joint experience. And I always find that it takes one person to start something, and then another person to join them, and then all of a sudden you have it just sort of builds from there. Because as soon as one person says something's cool, it automatically sort of becomes cool to do, and then communities can build. I feel like, and also any local community group, I cannot stress enough, there's always one, and that's the place where you can go to find people.
Start where you are.
Where you are. Yeah. It's the best place, usually.
Brilliant. We're going to come to Q&A in a minute, but I feel like, as a fellow autistic person, you've told us that your special interest at the moment is wolves. It would actually be violence if I didn't ask you about wolves. So you've got a wolf slot now for 7 minutes.
Okay. So 7 minutes of wolf.
Go.
Oh my God. One of the really interesting things about in Yellowstone, they were one of the main reintroduction projects. So they reintroduced the wolves to Yellowstone. This then took down the deer populations because the deers were overpopulating. This then caused all of the trees to grow back all of a sudden. This then changed the soil structure because now it had roots again. And then all of a sudden, a river appeared. This then caused the river to completely just change the entire landscape. All of a sudden it went from this slightly biodegraded area into this massively important reserve just by the reintroduction of wolves to this area. It literally moved a river.
Wow.
Wolves, which is so, so cool.
So cool.
I will also, I have to say that, too much things in brain.
Sorry.
There's a bunch of Irish myths around wolves as well, because my other main special interest is mythology. I think they made a film out of The Wolf Walkers, which is basically which is actually a part of the reason why Cromwell killed all of the wolves, and is actually a really, really good film. Go watch it. It's great. Whenever you go to sleep, you turn into a wolf. And it's like a common story in Irish mythology that some people are just, they have like the secret double life whenever they go to sleep. Wow. And it's like sort of original werewolf sort of story.
Okay.
And it's really, it's really, really cool, because in many cultures, the idea of a wolf is very masculinized. Mm. However, in Irish culture, it's this sort of feminine rage. It's the mother telling you that, you idiot. It's this really powerful idea of the pack and the togetherness and the community, and we run together. But in different cultures, like, wolves mean so many different things. Like in Turkey, they have the Turkish wolf, which is basically one of their main gods. And yeah, there's a lot of stuff I'm going to...
So I know nothing about wolves, but on the basis of the when someone says something's cool, it's cool.
Yeah.
Wolves are cool.
Wolves are cool.
Do you think that, because we were talking earlier about community, that there was something about undermining community in Ireland with the extinction of wolves?
Yes. That is my master's. That is literally my master's.
I get it.
It is literally because basically the idea of that mother spirit with the pack and the Irish connection to the wolves as being this community that was in touch with the natural world, and slightly these pagan ideas of being with the land, also mixed with the Christian ideas of community in that sense. The wolf symbolized all of that. So by removing the wolf, they sort of annihilated the community structures, because the symbol of the community was now being oppressed by the English colonizers. Like, the extinction of wolves is one of the fastest extinctions of any species that was highly, highly dominant in the country. They went functionally extinct about 60 to 70 years after the first wolf hunts were started, which is ridiculously fast. However, there was a few wolves that like survived longer than that, but they were so rare that like they were essentially functionally extinct by the time Cromwell had died. And it was but the effect that it had on the communities, it caused people to go into walled cities. It changed how farming was done. It caused the chopping down of the forests, it to make ships for the English, because now they didn't have the wolves there, and the Irish people they lost their connection to the land because it was seen as a thing that could be dominated now, not something that you lived in connection with. Gosh. And all of that sort of stemmed from the idea of the wolf in Irish society. I will have more information on this by next year after I go read some probably horrendously horrific accounts of Cromwellian violence, which I'm not looking forward to, but someone's got to read them, and I'm putting myself on the pyre for that one. And hopefully there's like more interesting things that will come out of that.
And you'll have your chapels, you'll have Grantchester Meadows, and those places of safety for while you're reading the horrendous stuff.
Yeah, I'm just going to go Library Meadows, and just like...
Spanish flag trees.
Yeah. And hopefully it should be good.
Yeah. Dara, you're a joy. talking to autistic people about their special interests is literally my favourite thing to do. So thank you so much for talking to me.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
We're looking forward to talking to all of you and having some Q&A. I'm going to shut up for a bit and let you chat to Dara. So if you've got any questions, please do raise your hand.
Can we give Dara a massive round of applause first? So how the questions will work, I'm sure we've got loads of questions. We're going to try and do as many as we can. So can you just keep it to one brief sentence, your question? Try not to include your opinion, just a question, so we can hear as much from Dara as possible. I will be trying to choose a range of people from the audience, so hopefully you will get a chance to hear your question. I will give the microphone to Michael. He'll bring it over to you. So first one, yes, please, over there.
Whoa. Oops. Come a bit closer.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Dara. Absolutely fantastic talk and insight. I was fascinated that you mentioned stone circles as one of your places of inspiration or calm. technically speaking, of course, those are artificial, but I guess that it feels right to me that that is considered part of your natural inspiration. Is do you think that human endeavor that is done well can be considered almost part of the natural world?
Well, I feel like I approach this point from the starting point that humans are also in the natural world. We are nature. We live in the natural world. And in the same way that a beaver will make a dam, the actions of humans are also a part of that natural world. And whenever we work in harmony with the natural world, those human creations can be incredible and are, and I think that's why I like stone circles, in that it connects the humans to the natural world in this very like intimate and spiritual way, that we are both in the natural world and we can feel that humans were also here and cared enough about this place to build this. And I feel like humans still, whenever we build things that were built with that harmony in mind, that connection in mind, I don't, yes, it's artificial, but in reality, I think it's artificial in the sense that it's man-made, but that assumes that man-made isn't nature-made as well. However, if you build a parking lot over a forest, that's like, I don't think you're working in harmony there.
Just like the red kites were reintroduced into the south of England, should we be reintroducing wolves to Ireland?
So I'm going to say I'm highly biased. I'm going to say yes. However, I think Ireland currently is going through a sort of like a renaissance of reintroduction of wolves, because they realize we realize something very quickly. Farmers don't really like wolves because they can attack livestock. However, someone pointed out the English took them from us, and this convinced a lot of Irish people very quickly. Nothing convinces Irish people to do something, even if it's entirely out of spite to the English. And it caused an actual cultural shift, that it became actually a part of our culture that was taken by the English and colonial power. And I think it reconnected us with the wolf in a strange sort of way, that we recognized that it was something that we lost. And that it should be there. And that actually provided more of a movement for reintroduction. You still need to get some of the farmers on board, but I think it's a lot closer than it initially thinks. I think people are going to start with the lynx, though, because that's a bit easier for apex predator reintroduction. But the wolf is actually on the cards, just about. Give it another 10 years, but it does require probably more of a cultural shift. I always find that rewilding and reintroduction is always a cultural problem rather than a scientific one. Like the reintroduction of red kites into Ireland was at the same time as the scientific end of the reintroduction. They had to do a lot of community project work, making people feel proud of the red kite, that it was a part of the landscape, and it really, really worked. The red kite, there was this story where the red kites had been like persecuted, and usually it wasn't from people in the community, and someone brought into the local pub a dead red kite that they had shot, and basically the community called the police on him and put him under civil arrest and said, "You don't touch our birds like that." And I think whenever you have a cultural thing like that, yeah, reintroductions have to work like that.
Sorry. When did you make the link between your fascination / hyperfixation with the natural world and being autistic? And how did that shape your interaction going forward?
So I was diagnosed very, very early. I think I was like 5. My teachers picked up on that one really. It was pretty obvious. And I think it never really changed how I experienced the natural world. I just sort of did. I don't really think about autism whenever I make up my thoughts. It just sort of exists there. So I don't think anything really changed. I just sort of was like, oh, well, that's what that's called. That's why I think that way. Moving on. Anyway, I'm gonna go bird watching now. And my life just sort of kept on like going. Because autism for me is just it. It's just it's me. I don't know. But yeah, thank you for your question.
Hi. So the sense of beauty in nature that you talk about so eloquently, do you think that's a cultural thing or a biological urge? And the reason I ask is because I have some friends who just don't seem to get it. You can take them to a forest and they're like, no, why are we here? Where's the pub? So I just wonder where you thought that comes from.
So I think it's, I think it might be both. I think that whenever you have a culture of loving first of all, I think we automatically start off with a connection to the natural world, and then culturally we then are turned away from it. Like we're taught that mud is dirty, insects are grubby, you're gonna get diseases from stuff. I've held enough bones in my life and I'm not dead yet. You'll be fine. And that it's a cultural conditioning away from a sort of a state that I think we're all sort of born innately with a desire to be in the natural world. But culturally, we get conditioned out of it, because obviously across human history, being indoors is quite a new thing. Not being in the natural world is an even newer thing. And not being able to just roam, go into a forest that's really, really nearby is an even newer thing. So I think that it is a sort of cultural conditioning away from caring about the natural world.
Hi, Dari, you have clearly spoken about your journey, as it were, sort of from being a young person and finding your voice and how nature is so important to you. Do you have any advice that you could offer for young people who are still kind of finding their path through maybe neurodiversity, how nature can help them, any kind of words of wisdom that you would pass on to people who are still travelling that path that you have been on?
I think the first bit of, because I don't know how I got here half the time. I feel like I did what I loved and wandered through life in that sense. But I think the most important thing to recognize is that you're on a path at the beginning, and paths, maybe the path doesn't actually end anywhere, but if you're on a path, you can in fact just keep on walking. And your brain usually knows, you can sort of feel where the path is. Sometimes it diverges, but as long as you keep on walking along it, you can sort of end up somewhere else. Who would have thought if you walk from one place to another, you end up somewhere else? But I think get involved with your local communities. Write, make art if you want to make art. Go to protests if you want to go to protests. Find the thing that gives you joy in the world. Follow your joy, most of all, I think, is the most important bit. Because what actually gives you that joy is usually the right place to head. And the most important thing is to sort of just keep going, because you will probably end up somewhere. And even when things feel hopeless, I have no idea. I feel like I'm a bad person to answer this question, because I don't even know what I'm doing next year after my master's. I have no life plans. I literally, I think of something to do, and then I find a way of managing my way to get there. beat up by scrounging, annoying people too much, or just being a busybody. I sort of just, I don't really know where I'm going, ever. And you can never be lost if you don't have a destination, really. If you just sort of wander for a bit, you can just go places. And I think that's quite a freeing frame of mind, because then you really can't go wrong.
What's your favourite bird?
Oh, now this is the question. Okay, so my favourite... Okay, this question changes, like, consistently. But the bird that has consistently been the most important in my life has been the hen harrier, It was that bird that I pledged my life to back in... whenever I was younger, I spent... it was the first conservation project that I had ever worked on was working for the Northern Ireland Raptor Study Group, monitoring hen harrier populations. I remember the first time I saw them and my brain just sort of fell out the side of my ear. And then probably second favorite is the red kite, because I've spent... whenever I sort of work with species, I like the birds that I can, I just sort of need to be with them. And then whenever they're there, I get really, really excited and it just lights me up.
Just a quick thought. How do you engage with nature if you happen to live and work in a very heavily urban environment and you don't have any choice about that?
So I, as a person who grew up whenever I was a child in Belfast, which is definitely a city of all time. I think I connected with the natural world through small things. I found the little green patches. I paid attention to insects, beetles, a lot of pigeons. You can surprisingly make friends with a lot of pigeons. I was consistently fascinated by the random things that I saw. I didn't get to see maybe that all that much. I found parks that I could go into, places that I would walk beside, and then whenever I was seven, I would spend all day in the park, and then I would literally have to be dragged out by my parents. And I think trying to find those places in urban environments, and then also as a community, making those communal spaces with the natural world, I think in this modern age where a lot of us do live in cities and in urban environments, it's becoming increasingly important. I remember my dad, whenever he was younger, used to live in an apartment block in London. And he basically would go down to the... he basically made his own, like, ponds and put it on the balcony. And then he would go, he would like walk for miles to get like frog spawn and put it into into jars and stuff. And he would try and find plants and stuff and try and bring the natural world into this apartment building when he was up on the seventh floor and no real green spaces, trying to bring it to him. And I think cities in general are, if you know where to look, the green spaces are there. Nature always finds a way of... nature is, I think, surprisingly resilient. I always find... Because that's the thing about the natural world. There's a slight tangent to your question now. But I always find that the natural world is a surprisingly resilient thing. We can cause enormous damage to the current natural world, but it always finds a way of existing in some other form, especially like even with climate change. The worst thing that's going to happen is all life currently changes and humans go extinct. But nature's just going to keep on going. However, I do think that human extinction this early on for a species, like, come on, we could have done better. like, that's not a good run. But the natural world survived as microscopic specks on a flooded planet, several global snowballs. It just keeps on going. And in urban environments, the natural world finds its way into creeping in. But yeah, thank you for your question. I hope it answered it in some way.
You have been an absolute joy to be in conversation with. Thank you for your wisdom and for your insight and for your passion. You're going to be with us over the weekend, which
yes,
is brilliant. I hope that you enjoy your first ever green belt. Enjoy the red kites.
Yes.
And everything else. You're going to be signing books in half an hour. So 12:30 over at G Books. Dara is going to be signing books. I'm assuming there are books here that people could purchase as well.
I believe so.
In G Books as well. So do that, because that's a really, really good idea. We will also be back at 4:30 in the Dungeon. If you've got people who are younger in your life, or if you are here as a young person and enjoy hanging out over there, then we will be over there having a chat later on at 4:30. But thank you so much, and the pearl of wisdom that I'm taking away is you can't be lost if you haven't got a destination.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.